Dark Winter Nights is produced with support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Journalism Department, preparing the next generation of bold and talented journalists. UAF Journalism. Tell great stories.
In this episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska.
This tape is for Tommy, Jay, and Johnny Craig from their big bud Jay. I'm making this tape on the 22nd of April, 1964. The reason that I'd like to make this tape for you three is that here a short while back, on the 27th of March, a pretty terrible thing happened here in Alaska. And I'd like to tell you the part that we had in it, some of the things that we saw.
Something terrible happens in Alaska, and one man records what he saw in an audio message for his family back in the lower 48.
I'd like for you to keep this tape so that someday you can play it again and maybe I can listen to it too.
This is Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska. I'm Rob Prince. A while back, I contacted the good people down in the University of Alaska Fairbanks Oral History Department to see if they had any good material for the program. I said, send me your favorite recording, and this is what they sent. Jay Grimes recorded this story onto a cassette tape shortly after he witnessed the aftermath of the massive 1964 earthquake. What he witnessed and experienced was truly incredible. So now I present Jay Grimes.
On the 26th of March, my wife, your Aunt Laura, and our little girl, Valkyrie, who's your niece, and our dog, Toss, all loaded up in our car to go from Fairbanks, which is in the interior of Alaska, right in the middle of the state almost. We were going to drive from there down to Seward to visit with Laura's mother and dad who live there. We planned to spend the Easter weekend there in Seward.
Seward is about a 10-hour drive south from Fairbanks and is located on the southern edge of the Kenai Peninsula. At the time, it was a big port for Alaska, with ships from Seattle and elsewhere unloading cargo for transport on the Alaska Railroad.
Well, we left that Thursday afternoon about 5 o'clock and drove down the road quite a way to a lodge or a hotel along the highway and spent the night there. The next morning we were up bright and early, and it was a nice day. It was snowing just a little bit, but it wasn't too cold. We all loaded up and started on for Seward. Then about 12 or 14 miles out of Seward, right about 5 o'clock. We were coming down a long hill. We'd been up in the mountains. And there was a big tractor-trailer truck that had been coming up the hill. It was stopped. And there was some snow on the highway here and some fresh snow on top of it. And the truck was having to put chains on so that he could make it up the hill. So we sat and waited about 15 minutes until the truck had got his chains on his tires. And while we were sitting there, we noticed that the car slid a little bit toward the edge of the road, and it was slanted the way, you know, they usually are on a sharp curve. And we thought that there was just ice underneath this fresh snow, and that's what made it slide. But we know now that this was the first part of the earthquake. Well, we went on down this hill and got to the bottom, and I noticed that I was having a hard time keeping the car on my side of the road. And again, we thought it was just like ice underneath this little bit of fresh snow that had fallen. So we drove on for about another mile or mile and a half, and we came to a pretty big crack in the road. I guess it was about 6 or 8 inches across. And we didn't stop, so I couldn't see the bottom of it, and wouldn't have been able to anyway, because mud and water was bubbling up out of it and running all over the road, and there were several other smaller cracks that the water was squishing out of, water and mud. And we knew then that there had been a pretty bad earthquake. Well, just after we got across this first bad crack, Laura looked up in the sky and said, gee, that's a funny looking cloud over there. And I looked too, and it did look strange. It looked just like it was coming from the town. And the longer we looked at it, the more we realized that this was something out of the ordinary. And then we decided that it was a fire and began to get worried, because the Texaco Oil Company had some great big storage tanks about 3 blocks from Laura's mother and dad. So I really stepped on it then and got in a hurry to get in the sewer to see if they were all right. Well, just about the time that I speeded up, we were watching the smoke, and we were still, I imagine, about 5 miles outside of town when we saw flames blaze up above the treetops. And from this far out of town, I knew that it must be a big fire and a hot fire, and was certain that it was one of either the Texaco Oil Company or the Standard Oil Company's storage tanks, because I couldn't think of anything else in town that'd make a flame that big. I imagine the flames were going well over 100 feet in the air when we saw them, and the smoke much higher than this. Well, about 4 miles outside of town, we came to a bridge over a little creek, and the shaking and bouncing of the earthquake had pushed it up above the level of the road, and it was popped up, about a foot. And on the right-hand side of the road there's a little cafe, and we thought we'd stop and see what the problem was and see if I could get across the bridge with the car. And about that time, a station wagon came just flying out from town and hit the bridge, and the bottom part of his car slammed against the bridge, and he bounced in the air and came over the bridge and slammed on his brakes and slid to a stop. And he screamed at us, "Turn around, turn around. There's a tidal wave coming. Sewer's gonna be washed away. Turn around, turn around." And then he took off. Well, we got awfully worried then about Laura's mother and dad, Johnny and Ruby. And I told Laura to take Valkyrie and Poss, our dog, and wait at the cafe, and that I'd be back just as soon as I could. And one side of the bridge was down a little closer to the road than the other, so I drove up on this and drove across the bridge and headed on in for town. Well, I was able to drive, just about a mile, when I saw a line of cars, and they were stopped almost exactly 3 miles outside of town, where there are 3 bridges, one right after the other, and they are all in about a quarter of a mile there together. And before I got to the bridges, I saw some very large cracks in the highway. The biggest one was possibly a foot, maybe 14 inches across, and was 30 or 35 feet long, cutting across the highway. So I pulled over and parked and jumped out of the car, and I saw then that the three bridges were all pushed up above the road, only they were much worse than the first little bridge by the cafe. The first bridge that I came to was maybe 3 feet up above the roadbed. It actually just squeezed it up out of the ground, and the road came along and just like a giant stair step bumped into the concrete part that holds the bridge up, kind of like legs. And I ran up and asked some people what had happened, and they said it was the earthquake. And I could see that the other two bridges were in the same or worse shape. And all I could think about at this time was that Johnny and Ruby, Laura's mother and dad, were in sewered and weren't able to get out, and that I had to get to them to help them if I could in any way. So I decided to take off running, and what I thought of was that, well, I know I can't run the whole 3 miles into town, so I'll run 100 steps and walk 100 steps and get into town as quick as I can that way. Well, I did this until I got across all three bridges, and all three were pushed up or popped up higher than the road by, at least 2 feet on the lowest one and as high as 4 feet on one that I had to climb up on. And between the bridges were big cracks in the pavement of the road, like the ones I mentioned before. They were anywhere from 10 to 16 inches wide, and when you look down into them, they went down about 10 or 12 feet and then angled off toward the bay. Well, I was really worried about Laura's mother and dad because I could see the town from where I was on these bridges, and I could see the flames billowing up, flames and smoke just pouring up out of the town. The flames were 100 to 150 feet in the air, and then huge clouds of black oily smoke that rose. I couldn't even guess how high they went into the air, but they were up higher than the mountain there beside the town, and the mountain's 3,000 feet tall. I just took a little break here to rest my voice for a while. Well, excuse me, like I said before, we were awfully worried about Johnny and Ruby, and I was especially because they both had a disease, something like polio. It isn't the kind that cripples you. It just makes your muscles weak so that you can't do too much at one time without getting very, very tired. And I knew that they'd have to have some help if they were going to get out of town. Well, just as I was getting to the end of this third bridge, I looked up and saw, well, I had seen this long line of cars there before. I guess there were 15 or 20 cars in the line stopped at this bridge because they couldn't get across. And the second car in the line was a little blue Volkswagen, just like the one that Johnny and Ruby own. And I thought, well, maybe, just maybe it's them. And I saw a man and woman standing talking with another man, and from this distance I couldn't be sure who it was, but I thought for sure, or I thought maybe it was Johnny and Ruby. And when I got a little closer, I saw that it was them, and so I ran just that much faster. And Ruby grabbed me in her arms and began to cry and told me that it was just terrible, that I couldn't believe the damage that it had done. And she calmed down right away, and I said hello to Johnny and shook his hand. And then they told me that what had happened to him.
At this point in the story, the audio recording starts to be a little difficult to understand, so I'll fill you in on what happened until the recording gets better. Jay Grimes' mother and father-in-law, Ruby and Johnny, were in their house when the earthquake began. At first, they didn't think much of it, but then it got more and more intense. Ruby said she looked up and the refrigerator was bouncing so much it started to dance out into the kitchen. One of the cabinets came open and dishes and glasses began to fall out and crash onto the floor and break. They began to get worried because it was much worse than any earthquake they had ever been through before. The walls were waving back and forth and the floor was bouncing up and down, so they decided the best thing to do was to go outside in case the house were to fall apart. So they both ran out into the yard, and as soon as they got out of the house, the earthquake intensified and the ground was shaking harder and harder. They were very afraid because the earthquake was so strong that they couldn't really stand up. Ruby grabbed onto a clothesline with one hand and held onto Johnny with the other, and it was all they could do just to stay on their feet. While this was going on, Johnny began to worry about the possibility of the ground opening up, and as he thought of this, he looked down and a crack began to form at the house and move toward them. Johnny and Ruby both said that they tried as hard as they could to get away from the crack, but the ground was bucking so hard that they just couldn't move. They said it felt like there was some sort of tremendous pressure pulling them, and they were powerless to fight against it. The crack moved closer and closer to them until it ran right between Johnny's feet. It opened up about 4 inches, but never got any wider than that. All the while, they said there was an awful roar in the air that was so loud they had to scream at the top of their lungs just to hear each other. When the earthquake began to let up enough that they could move around again, they decided to jump into their car and get out of town. Just as they started to move toward the car, they saw one of the Standard Oil tanks explode and flames leap into the air. And then, almost immediately after, another tank cracked open and exploded in flames. They got into their car and raced to get out of town. In Seward, at the edge of town, there's a lagoon, and to get out of town, you have to cross about a quarter mile long road that runs through the lagoon. Just as they were getting onto this road, they saw a tsunami coming right toward them. They said it was a wall of black mud, with log pilings, boards, and boxes, and on top of this 15 to 20 foot high wall of water was what Johnny described as a really big boat. They drove as fast as they could to get across the lagoon before the tsunami hit them. They did beat it and got to higher ground, where they raced on until they came to the three bridges that had been knocked out by the earthquake and could go no further. Here's Jay Grimes again.
There were men and women and little children, and women crying and little children afraid and scared, and they could look back and see what the wave was doing to the town, and they knew that there had been other people behind them that were trying to get across this road. And they knew that they had barely beat the wave across, and they didn't know how many people had been on the lagoon, on the lagoon road when the wave came across. Well, it was just about this time that I came running across the bridges, and since our car was on the side away from town of the bridges, we decided the best thing for us all to do was to cross the bridges, get in our car, go and get Laura and Valkyrie and Haas, and I took another little break here to rest my voice up again. Well, as I was saying a minute ago, the three of us, Johnny and Ruby and I, got in our car and went on back out to the little cafe and picked up Laura and Valkyrie. And we decided that the best bet, since there were so many of us, was to leave Paz, the dog, there. So we chained him up outside the place and we talked it over for just a little bit and decided that the best bet would be to stop at one of our relations, Mr. and Mrs. Irv Tressler, who live about 6 miles outside town. By this time it was beginning to get dark, and we drove on out to Irv's and went in there, and there were several people there. One of our cousins' wives came in, and she was crying and terribly upset because they had lost their home and lost their car, and she wasn't too sure where her husband was. He had been on a boat and had come and gotten her, and got her and their child to safety and then gone back. Well, we got in and talked on the radio with a Standard Oil tanker, the Alaska Standard, that was out in the bay, and he told us about some of the things that had happened to him. And we talked with the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard wanted to know what sort of shape the runway was in on the airport there outside of Seward. We had several reports that most of it had been washed away. And they asked that someone go in and check and see what kind of shape it was in. Johnny and I wanted to see about the house too, so I decided that I'd go in and see what I could see. So I jumped in the car again and drove into the Three Bridges.
I know what you're thinking, and you're right. I can't fit this whole story into 30 minutes, so I've got to continue it in the next episode. I'm sorry, I know how irritating that is. But don't worry, there's more Dark Winter Nights online to tide you over until then. Just check out darkwinternights.com, where you can find more information about the show and get a link to download the podcast. Today's episode was edited by myself, Rob Prince. Audio and story consultation by Lori Neufeld. Special thanks to Leslie McCartney and Robin Russell from the Oral History Department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks for connecting me with this recording. Dark Winter Nights is distributed by KUAC, located on the campus of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Hey, if you've got a great story about Alaska or know someone who does, please submit it at darkwinternights.com, and thanks. These are the stories we tell up here in Alaska, and these are the stories we tell on Dark Winter Nights. I'm Rob Prince. Would you like to see Dark Winter Nights live and in person? Our next live event is going to be Friday, January 9th at 7 p.m. in the Murry Auditorium on the campus of UAF. We're calling it Dark Winter Nights Light because it's only going to be an hour long and we aren't going to have a band, but it's going to be fun, it's going to be family friendly, and it's free. So we'll see you Friday, January 9th at the Murry Auditorium on UAF's campus. There's more information at darkwinternights.com. Coming up on the next episode of Dark Winter Nights.
I've never seen that much fire in any one place in all my life. And it was a horrible sight to see, and I'm not ashamed to admit I was really scared, and it really made me feel bad to think that this beautiful little town was burning up.
Jay Grimes heads back into Seward to witness the devastation. Part 2 of Earthquake, next time on Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska. Coming up in a future episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska. Okay, so here's the deal. The Bukta family has this property at Seymour Lake near Wasilla, Alaska, about an hour from where they live in Anchorage. Melissa is about 13 and her brother Christopher is about 8 at the time. Picture a sunny summer Sunday evening by the lake. Got it? Okay, here's Melissa.
Well, Sunday night rolled around, and around 5:30 on Sunday night, we start packing up to leave because everybody's got to go to work in the morning. And we packed up the trailer and packed up the food and put the fire out and did everything. And our friends had been camping on the property with us that weekend, our really good friends. We'd all been swimming, all the kids had. So we all had to get out of the water and dry off and get dressed and everything. And my brother, who was only in third grade, got really tired and cranky. So Mom was like, okay, we'll dry him off. You go in the camper, climb into one of the bunks, which were located in the back of the camper where him and I slept, and sleep. And we'll just come and get you when it's time to go. It was a good-sized camper, not like a fancy-schmancy Winnebago or anything, but it was a good-sized camper that we just brought up there and parked. So the camper was our cabin. So the camper never left the property.
Got it.
So we pack everything up. We all get in the car and everything, and I get in my friend's motorhome with their kids, and my brother doesn't come. And we talk about, like, we said, you know, this is really weird. He said he was going to ride home with us. Well, I guess he was, and what I said, you know, is he was really tired. So I think Mom and Dad just grabbed him and put him in the backseat of the truck. Well, that sounds plausible. So we leave. So my Mom and Dad get in their truck, and he doesn't get in. And they're like, oh, well, he obviously woke up, got dressed, went into Sarah and Randy's camper, and is riding home with all the kids, because that's a plausible situation. Okay, so they leave. So we get home, and the campsite's about an hour away from Anchorage. We get to Sarah and Randy's house, and we all pile out and goof around and waiting for my parents to come pick me up. And they get there and da-da-da-da-da. And
here's Melissa's mom.
We get out of the truck and said, you know, where's Christopher? Because everybody else is outside playing. Where's Christopher? I don't know. Where is Christopher? This is what our friend said. And I said, I was like, no, really, where is Christopher? He's like, really? He said, where is Christopher?
And Randy's like, listen to me. We do not have your son. And like, silence. And we all look at each other, and it just dawns on us. Like, it hits like a lightning bolt. It hits everybody at the exact same time. And my parents just run, and they get in the truck and just, and they're screaming down the street.
While the Buchtas are racing back to the lake, their friend Pete calls the Wasilla police and explains the situation and their fear that Christopher may have gone back into the lake and drowned.
So we also called our cousin who was here in town, and he was also police officer, and we talked to him, and he said he would go to our house because just in case somebody brought Christopher, and I'm like, who would bring Christopher, you know? He's up at the lake drowned somewhere.
Stranded in the Alaskan wilderness, coming up in a future episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska.
Dark Winter Nights is produced with support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Journalism Department, preparing the next generation of bold and talented journalists. UAF Journalism. Tell great stories. Thanks for listening to this episode of Dark Winter Nights. Want more Alaska stories? Check out the Dark Winter Nights podcast, available now on iTunes or online at darkwinternights.com. We need your Alaska stories. If you've got a great story to tell or know someone who does, head over to darkwinternights.com, where you can submit your idea and get more information about the program.